It's a great pleasure to welcome you to the Massachusetts Historical Society, Gene.
Thanks, Jane. We're in the midst of the sesquicentennial of the Civil War, and the new Lincoln movie is out, so there's a lot of fertile ground for themes. And the theme tonight that grew out of this ground is this innocent-looking little cotton ball. This is a map maker, history maker, and troublemaker. And one of the the major depictions of this, of course, is at the Fog, the Edgar Degas painting of his cousin's cotton brokerage firm in New Orleans. And so let's take a look at New Orleans at that point in time. So this would be New Orleans on the eve of the Civil War in the 1850s. And this is the harbor in New Orleans. And you can see what a dynamic environment it is. It looks like Shanghai or Hong Kong today. So that's the cotton world that existed before the Civil War. Cotton is arguably the major determinant of the American experience in the 19th century because it prolonged slavery. And slave-produced cotton, you can't separate the two.
Sorry about that.
Slavery and cotton. So slavery and cotton produced the American Civil War, our ultimate tragedy. It also spawned two revolutions. One, the aforementioned American Civil War, and secondly, the Industrial Revolution. It was the young Karl Marx in 1848 who said, without cotton, you have no modern industry. Without slavery, you have no cotton. And who was Marx's chief financial backer? It was Frederick Engels. And where did the Engels money come from? It came from a cotton textile manufacturing business in Manchester, England. So to some extent, cotton helped the development of both communism and capitalism. And we have forgotten a little bit about this. The museum editor for the New York Times, Edward Rothstein, wrote this year, January 2012, he said he understood why slavery existed, but he didn't understand why it persisted. And that, to me, is a huge gap in terms of our education. Now, the story starts very early in 1787 at the Constitutional Convention, when there was virtually no cotton grown in America and slavery was enshrined in the Constitution. The Founding Fathers was faced with a very ugly choice. That choice was a nation with slavery or no nation without slavery. So what were their priorities? We know what their priorities were. You couldn't have even brought up the slavery issue seriously. The whole convention would have been disbanded. So they chose a nation with slavery. And how did it happen? The Constitution was brokered between two trading states, Connecticut and South Carolina. And why did the anti-slavery delegates, Oliver Ellsworth and Roger Sherman from Connecticut, accede to this? They were both vehemently anti-slavery. In the words of Oliver Ellsworth, slavery will not become a speck on the horizon. Roger Sherman, his mentor, said it was dying anyway. So they thought that slavery would become extinct. Well, it didn't. And at this point, I want to interject. We're going to look at something. We're going to ask not only what people thought about slavery, we're going to ask what they thought about race, because this is the key to what happened during and after Reconstruction and their ramifications today. Take a look at Benjamin Franklin. Anti-slavery at the time of the convention, but we know he owned slaves. We know that he was a lobbyist for the state of Georgia when he lived in England for the approval of Georgia's slave codes. Now, in 1789, after the convention, he wrote a paper and said that free blacks should be supervised by a national police force. He also said that free blacks should be trained for jobs that required little skill. So what happened to this prediction of extinction of slavery? It was blindsided by this economic tornado of cotton. And take a look at the two things that brought this about. that we're somewhat familiar with. One was the technological revolution in England that led to mass production of cotton textiles. Now, what did this mean? In very simple terms, between the Constitutional Convention in 1787 and in the mid-1830s, the price of a cotton garment dropped by over 90%. So this created a mass worldwide consumer revolution. Before this period, well, at the beginning that we're talking about, 75% of all garments in Europe were wool. At the end of this period, 75% were cotton. So where did all this cotton come from? It came from one place. 90% of it came from the American South. So this allowed huge demand, supply growing, and no interruption of price except for the usual small volatility. The second part, of course, is Eli Whitney, born in Massachusetts, as we know, and 1792 graduate of Yale College, the oldest member of his class, didn't do particularly well, couldn't get a job, was in debt, so became a tutor in the South, and within 2 weeks had created a gadget. It wasn't even an invention that separated the seed from the lint. And what this meant was a huge labor-saving device. One person could take the seed out, because you can't run unclean cotton through a machine. It'll tear up the machine. One person could clean 50 pounds a day versus 1 pound. And there were continual improvements on this apparatus throughout, even until now, but his basic principle stands. There is no indication that he cared one whit about slavery during this period. Nothing. He never wrote in all of his correspondence anything about slavery. So what you have is somewhat paradoxical. You have a labor-saving device that created this huge demand for labor. And what did this mean? From nothing to, on the eve of the Civil War, America's production went from almost zero to 4.5 million 450-pound bales of production. Gigantic. The number of slaves increased from 700,000 to 4 million. 65 to 70% of those people were directly or indirectly connected to cotton. If you could see a graph, which I have if you're interested, the price of a slave was directly correlated with the price of cotton. Not tobacco, not anything else, only cotton. When the price of cotton went down, the price of a slave went down. When the price of cotton went up, the price of a slave went up. Slavery only spread where you could grow cotton. At 4 cents a pound for cotton, slavery withered. At 11 cents a pound, it spread. At $1.90 a pound during the American Civil War, the entire Union officer corps on the Western Front was corrupted in terms of smuggling. At 40 cents a pound after the Civil War, hordes of white Northerners came south to grow cotton, and they all went broke, including Henry Lee Higginson. So a slave was extremely valuable. And in order to do dangerous work in the South, working on levees, there were malaria ridden, you could not use a valuable slave. So who were the expendable class? The expendable class were the Irish. If an Irish person died, you threw him in a ditch. If a slave died, you had to compensate the owner. On the eve of the Civil War, the largest cotton-producing state in America was Mississippi, 1,250,000 bales. It went from a population of almost nothing at the beginning of this period to 800,000 on the eve of the American Civil War. 450,000 slaves, and the balance were white people. So you ended up with this huge production from this area defined the state of Mississippi. In the secession convention of Mississippi, it voted 84-15 to secede from the Union. It voted 66 to 13 to prohibit the international slave trade. Now, what's going on here? What's going on here is that we must always remember that slavery was an economic organization. The social rationalization came after that. Without an economics, it would die. Now, cotton was not a regional phenomenon. It was important to America. 50% of all exports from America before the Civil War were cotton, and it gave the new country its sea legs. It knitted the country together. Foodstuffs came in from the West to the South. New York was very important. 35 to 40% of all cotton revenue ended up in New York City. So from the time it left the enslaved black hand to the accountant's ledger, it became sanitized during this period. So in the 1830s, to show you how significant it was, who were the major antagonists in the 1830s? There was President Andrew Johnson and the president, the head of the Bank of the U.S., Nicholas Biddle. Andrew Johnson was a cotton farmer. Nicholas Biddle was a speculator in cotton, which ultimately brought him down. And in terms of this, the financial impact, every time there was a land sale of an expansion in the cotton territory, the purchasers were essentially urban, particularly from Boston and particularly from New York. Now, in terms of the slave trade, we know that there was a slave market, physical market in New Orleans. Everybody knows about that. But there was an enormous slave trade that was based in New York City before the Civil War. And essentially, it wasn't obviously a physical market, but ships were fitted out, financed in New York, sent to the west coast of Africa, where they bought human beings, and those people were sold to Brazil and Cuba, not the U.S. The Trinity Church down on Wall Street, still one of the top 10 real estate owners in New York, the congregation there was very involved with that. So the anti-slavery John Jay spoke at the Trinity Church and tried to get a resolution passed to condemn the slave trade. He was jeered and laughed at. This was in the late 1850s, and the resolution was unanimously defeated. Interestingly enough, the New York merchants on the eve of the Civil War were very much opposed to a war with the South, because the South owed them money. The goods that were shipped from, manufactured goods went from Boston and New York to the American South. Huge trade. They wanted a compromise. So there was a huge, tens of thousands of signatures on petitions to avoid any sort of war. That was January of 1861. The New York merchants did a complete flip-flop within 2 months. By the end of March, they were vehemently in favor of a war with the South. And the reason was they understood that the South was going to open a free trade zone with England, and New York would be bypassed as a port. It would have decimated the New York port. So let's move on. History is not necessarily a narrative. It can be a puzzle. And here we're going to move to the key understanding of race, particularly in the North, and the ramifications it would have throughout American history. Let's take Connecticut, for example. 1784, gradual emancipation bill was passed. In 1800, there was a survey that was taken in Connecticut in Article 27. It was a census. In Article 27 of that survey asked the following question. Was a black person born free different from one who was born enslaved in terms of morals and industry? And the results came back and they were damning. The president of Yale, Timothy Dwight, wrote the part from New Haven, and he said, "These people are generally neither inclined nor able to make their freedom a blessing. Their hatred of labor becomes a habit. Therefore, they are left as miserable victims of sloth, poverty, and ignorance." every single town in Connecticut, virtually the same comment. So within a couple years, a colonization society was started in Connecticut to try to eliminate the population, the black population. And secondly, blacks were disenfranchised in Connecticut. Connecticut, even after the Civil War, voted against the 15th Amendment. Now, why is this significant? Because the black population of Connecticut was 1.5%. Now, why would you care about 1.5% of the population? So this was the forerunner in terms of what would happen. If you can't assimilate 1.5% of the population, what's going to happen when you get a larger population? The North was extremely fearful of a black migration at this point. One of the most famous citizens of Connecticut, Harriet Beecher Stowe, we know what Lincoln allegedly said, that she was the little lady who wrote the book that started the war. So what did she think about cotton? In Uncle Tom's Cabin, she wrote that if something would bring the price of cotton down permanently, slavery would become a burden. Now, we know what she thought about slavery. What did she think about black people? What did she do with the heroes and heroines of Uncle Tom's Cabin? In the words of George Harris, he said, "I have no desire to mingle with whites in America. I want to move to Africa." So she sent them to Africa, all of the heroes and heroines of Uncle Tom's Cabin. Frederick Douglass, when he read this, said, "Lady, we are here and we are here to stay." When Douglass was trying to raise money for a school for African Americans in Washington, D.C., she turned him down. In her correspondence later, she said, "When will they ever learn to walk? When will they ever learn to walk?" How many of you knew that Harriet Beecher Stowe was a cotton farmer? After the Civil War, she financed her son's cotton farm in Florida, and it failed. Like most of the cotton is a very risky business, and the price of cotton was very high, so she found out what it was like to work in an environment where there were insects. Henry Lee Higginson from Boston, same story. He was married to Ida Agassiz, as many of you know. He went down to Georgia with a couple of his army buddies, and here's what he had to say, talking about African Americans. "They still do not understand the value of work and wages. Their moral perceptions are deficient, either from nature or habit or ignorance." He failed as well and left. His wife said that their mission had failed, and she said she liked black people only at a distance. He, of course, was the major benefactor of the Boston Symphony and other organizations here. Let's move west for a while. Illinois, 1813, when Illinois was a territory. Any free black or mulatto who enters the territory will be, unless they leave within 2 weeks, will be administered 39 lashes. The Midwestern states, Indiana, Ohio, Illinois, all had exclusion laws, in addition to all sorts of prohibitions in terms of jury service, etc. These were exclusion laws. They didn't want people in. They had to post a bond. 1862, during the American Civil War, there was a vote in terms of black suffrage. 5-1, Illinois residents voted to prohibit the black population in Illinois from voting. Do you know what that population was? It was 0.5%. So what is going to happen after the Civil War is going to be a reflection not of slavery, but of race. So you could be anti-slavery, but also anti-black. Radical Republican John Sherman said, "The mass of this country opposed to slavery morally, socially, and politically, but Ohio does not like blacks. They are spurned and hated all over the country." Salmon Chase, another situation, wanted Massachusetts General Benjamin Butler to emancipate slaves and keep them on the Gulf Coast. Charles Sumner, as well as Thaddeus Stevens, wanted black people drained to the South. So this is the mentality that existed before the Civil War. Let's see what happens during and after the Civil War. Now, what was the South's strategy, the Confederate strategy during for war? It was clearly based on a cotton embargo. As we all know, it failed. Jefferson Davis, in his first address as president of the Confederacy, challenged the North. He said, if you tamper with our great staple, we will retaliate. This was not the first time that Americans had threatened Great Britain with a cotton shortage. The first occurred in the 1830s when Nicholas Biddle in Philadelphia tried to manipulate the cotton market, exactly pointing to England and said, we're going to force them to pay higher prices for cotton. Again, Massachusetts Benjamin Butler tried this same technique in 1870 with England. So why didn't it work if cotton was so important? Well, the reason it didn't work, the reason it failed so miserably, because even if it had worked, we know the South would have been more efficient, but we don't know if it would have been a determining factor. Inexplicably, the Confederacy did not know that England had an inventory of 1,200,000 bales of cotton, so that the projected social unrest in England did not occur until 1862. Now, England, the most powerful nation in the world at the time, had 22 million people. 4 to 5 million of those people were directly or indirectly involved with the cotton textile industry, and they were all located in the Lancashire area. Now, if this is beginning to sound a lot like oil today, hold that thought, because the power of cotton in the 19th century was equal to that of oil today, and in some ways it was greater than that because of this control of a labor force. What happened, the famine did occur in 1862, but fortunately it occurred after the Battle of Antietam, when England did not want to get into any sort of confrontation with the American North at this point, because the American North had threatened to take over Canada, which would have solved our energy problems. So, how was cotton important during the Civil War? It was important for two reasons. One, it was used as barter for arms. And to give you one example, the ship, the blockade runner, the Fingal, took arms, massive amounts of arms, in 1862 before the Battle of Shiloh into Savannah. They were shipped across by rail to Shiloh to equip the Confederate army. And that's one example. The raiders, the Alabama, the Shenandoah, and the Florida, were built in English shipyards. And if you've ever been to Liverpool and looked at Birkenhead, these are gigantic. There was no mystery about what was going on. So England was not neutral during this war. They armed the South. Interestingly, we think the blockade was effective. The blockade was a sieve. What stopped the pouring in of arms from England was the land control of the southern ports. And when was the last one closed? The last one, southern port that was closed, was late in the war, January 1865 in Wilmington, North Carolina. So England was continuing to pour material into the South. What's interesting also is what happens in a war when the price of cotton goes from 10 to 11 to $1.90s. And this was the point. It was totally frustrating for Grant and Sherman. And that's when they issued the famous Order 11, which was kicking the Jews out of the Tennessee department. And they were totally frustrated. Whereas Lincoln Lincoln didn't care. This is probably not, will not be in the movie. And Lincoln said, never, never has so much good come from pecuniary greed. It should be remembered that Lincoln, before he was president, was not a politician. He was a corporate lawyer and did a lot of tax work defending the Illinois Central Railroad. But just give you one quote of a journalist there. Every colonel, this is in the Union Army, or quartermaster is in secret partnership with some operator in cotton. Every soldier dreams of adding a bale of cotton to his monthly pay. This is actually indicating the power of cotton. This is a banknote from Conway, Massachusetts, and these banknotes were all over the state of Massachusetts. And if you can take a look at this corner here, you have actually a slave. This is in the 1850s. You have a slave with cotton there. So that's how significant, as we know, it was to the Massachusetts textile industry. This is the forerunner of all modern finance. It's a Southern bond that was issued in 1863. The South's strategy should have been to ship cotton immediately to Europe and to borrow against it. What is so significant about this, this was the forerunner of all international finance. It was convertible into two currencies, pound sterling and French francs, and also was convertible into cotton. It was traded on all major exchanges in Europe at the time, and also was owned by the elite of Great Britain, the editor of the London Times, Gladstone, members of Parliament, etc. So don't worry, I'm not going to do the financial part much longer. Now, if this was such a moral war, who were the North's allies? There were no allies for the North. Europe wanted America dismantled. Make no mistakes about that. England supplied arms, as we know, to the American South. I want to look at three examples that will indicate to me what's going to happen after the Civil War. The first was the famous draft riots. It was a race riot, make no mistake about that, in New York City. Troops from New York were pulled back after the victory at Gettysburg to quell this riot. The second one is what to do with free blacks during this period. And as the Union forces moved south, there were slaves who were behind Union lines. And so the Army did not know what to do with them. General John Dix, first proposal was to send them to Massachusetts. And John Andrew, the hero of the movie Glory, said, no, we don't want them. They'll end up as paupers. That was 1862. In 1864, he wrote Lincoln a letter and said, please send them up here. And Lincoln was very sarcastic because he knew exactly what John Andrew wanted to do. He wanted to fill draft quotas. And so he would have these people shipped up, fill draft quarters, and move back south. The same thing occurred on the Western Front in September of 1862 when, in the Mississippi Valley, former slaves were sent up to Illinois. Race riots broke out throughout Illinois. The policy was stopped in 30 days, and these people were forced to work on leased plantations where northern lessees cheated them without abandon. The other is the Emancipation Proclamation, which we're about to celebrate on January the 1st, triumph of American history. What bill did Lincoln sign the day before he signed the Emancipation Proclamation? An appropriation bill to colonize black people on an island off Haiti. Take a look at what some of the radical Republicans' views were in terms of race. William Seward, very important 19th century figure, new biography about him, governor of New York, senator from New York, Lincoln's right hand. The great fact is the African race here is foreign and feeble element, incapable of assimilation. The North has nothing to do with Negroes. They're nothing more than Hottentots. They are God's poor. They always will be. He voted against suffrage in the cabinet, and he actually was in favor of it in New York State, but his correspondent said the only reason he was in favor of it was because the black population in New York was negligible. This man had enormous foresight in terms of commercial. He was the first guy to recognize the significance of Asia, but we can talk about that later. Lincoln himself was no sponsor of 40 acres and a mule, and as a matter of fact, he was very much in favor of diffusion. What the diffusion, and there were two bills, which is basically taking black people from the South and spreading them around the country so that they would be more acceptable, as it were, to the North. In Boston, Edward Tobey, head of the Boston Board of Trade, if the freed slaves refuse to labor, the scripture rule will be applied. If any will not work, neither shall they eat. Edward Atkinson. Edward Atkinson was very much a proponent, anti-slavery proponent. He supplied arms to John Brown in Kansas, and he was the person who was responsible for raising the money for the monument for the 54th Regiment on the Commons. What did he have to say about black people? We must admit that we must have cotton and that the emancipated slave will be idle unless he works in the cotton field. If he does not work, let him starve and exterminate himself if he will, and so remove the Negro question. Still, we must have cotton. New York Times, February 1865. We must get cotton back into production. That means two things, white ingenuity and black labor. And it said in quotes that the black person must live side by side for centuries with the civilized white person, a few individuals rising to the level of equality. So the South was utterly defeated after the American Civil War. And the North could have done anything that it wanted to. The premise that's coming out of this book is that white Northerners were not going to shed white Southern blood for black rights. The people in arms, over a million, in May of 1865 was reduced to a handful within a few years. And even the 14th and 15th Amendment could be viewed to some extent as expediency. Listen to one of the congressmen. Whenever the colored man is completely and fully protected in the southern states, he will never visit Illinois and he will never visit Indiana, and every northern state will be depopulated of colored people as well as will be Canada. Incidentally, Canada, the refuge for the fugitive slaves before the Civil War, as soon as the Civil War started, they immediately cut off all aid, and 75% of those people came back south. Whose side in the Civil War was Canada on? It was a Southern sympathizer. And the reason was the first battle of Bull Run was cheered in the Canadian Parliament. And the reason was they were very fearful of an American invasion of Canada. By the late 19th century, Canada had black exclusion laws. George Boughton, Massachusetts politician. What he wanted to do was create a black enclave in Georgia, South Carolina, and Florida. So all black people in America would be moved to that area. They would be given those states. And he, again, did not want them to move north. Grant sent an expedition, including Frederick Douglass, to the Dominican, what was now the Dominican Republic, as a safety valve, because he knew that situation in America for black people would probably not work. Listen to this timeline. As we know, Charles Sumner was beaten by Preston Brooks in 1856 in Congress. In 1874, the Massachusetts delegation selected L.Q.C. Lamar from Mississippi to deliver the eulogy for Charles Sumner. L.Q.C. Lamar was the person who wrote the secession papers for the state of Mississippi. He was also one of the main architects of the redemption policy, which was taking the vote away from black people in Mississippi. In 1886, Lamar, who was given an honorary degree in Harvard, and also in 1955, he was one of the profiles in Courage that was in John Kennedy's book. So what this meant was an interesting phenomenon, which I call a containment policy. Direct during the Civil War and indirect after the Civil War. Between 1865 and World War I, the black population of the North stayed the same, under 2%, when 20 million white Americans came in. So this was a deliberate policy of keeping black people out of the North. Massachusetts, for example, in the 1930s, which is where the book ends, had a black population of 52,000. That was 1.3%. That was the exact same population that the state of Massachusetts had in 1850. There was one county in Mississippi, Bolivar County, that had the same number of people. Cotton was, again, significant in terms of this linkage between race and cotton. Andrew Carnegie, the first serious money in America was made at the end of the 19th century, as we know. Rockefeller, Rosenwald, Carnegie, etc. And Carnegie gave the seed money for Tuskegee Institute in Alabama. And in 1903, when he gave this huge donation, he said, "We cannot have enough cotton for the wants of the world." What he wanted to do was create a university that created efficient cotton producers. We cannot afford to lose the Negro. We must have urgent need of all and more to produce cotton. And just take this timeline further. Theodore Roosevelt, 95% of all black people should not be allowed to vote or hold office, but he supported the 5% who he thought were worthy, for sure. Albert Bushnell Hart, Harvard professor, anti-slavery, impeccable background in terms of his ancestors, wrote a book called The Southerner South in 1910, which he said 90% of all black people are inferior. Who was his most famous, illustrious student? It was W.E.B. Du Bois. So again, you get this in the white American psyche, there was always room for a black elite. The year later, he wrote a book called The Obvious Orient, which again predicted the rise of Asia. Let's move back to cotton a little bit. Cotton, it was thought that Egypt had impinged upon the American cotton market during this period. It didn't. As soon as the American Civil War ended, America began to dominate the export market. Three-quarters of cotton exports before the 1930s were American cotton. Cotton was the leading export in this country between 1803 and 1937. Nothing will ever match that. So cotton production roared back. And how was it financed? So you had to, this is all a financing vehicle. Everything's a pawn of finance, as we know today. If you're a cotton farmer and you can't use your mortgage effectively, what do you have? If you go as a cotton farmer into a bank and the banker says, "What's your business? Explain it to me." And the cotton farmer said, "Well, I don't know how much I'm going to plant. I don't know what the insect situation is. I don't know what the weather's going to be. I don't know what the price is going to be. And I don't know what my production is going to be. And, oh, by the way, I only get paid once a year." And the banker's going to scratch his head and said, "Okay, I'll lend you money, but I get the first call on your crop." So that's the infamous lien system. Nobody came up with a better solution to that until the subsidies came out in the 1930s, etc. So the sharecropping situation, which was first initiated by black people, came into existence because of the capital requirements. Now, it seems like what a financier would call an equity participation. There was only one problem with it. It was totally arbitrary. The black person was completely dependent on the honesty or dishonesty of the white farmer. So there were huge abuses in that situation. Technology. Again, technology failed in terms of the cotton production. There were 750 patents on a mechanical cotton picker that were issued between 1860 and the 1930s when they were first successfully made. Nevertheless, cotton production went from 4.5 million bales to 17 million bales by the 1920s. Huge, huge production in that regard. And when you look at labor conditions during this period, you know, they were pretty harsh in America. Whether you dealt with the West Pennsylvania coal mines, the Carnegie steel mills, or how many of you have been to the Tenement Museum in New York? I mean, this is the way people lived. And the only problem that nothing like that resonates today, only race resonates today. When you go into a museum of a coal mine or even a tenement museum, it doesn't resonate. We get to the 1930s, and the reason that I end in the 1930s is because cotton is dethroned. It becomes a permanent ward of the federal government. Also, this was the period when legal segregation was still enshrined in our system. This was the only attempt at mass migration before World War I. This is the Exoduster movement, which occurred in Kansas in 1879. This is a Harper's illustration. This is a little bit out of order. But what happened was, because of the oppressive conditions in the South and the price of cotton, black people tried to move to Kansas. Kansas, the scene of bloody Kansas in the 1850s, didn't want them, said no. So only a few thousand went in there. The Great Migration, of course, started during World War I. What happened? Another economic force intervened, a war. War means industry booms. Unemployment went from 8.5% to 1.5%, no white immigration. So what happened? Black people were sucked into these factories in the North, and there were race riots all over the North, and ghettos followed. This would be something from Business Week in the 1930s. This was a national press. This was the kind of world that we lived in the 1930s. Bringing this back to cotton, this is the cover of Time magazine, and the guy on the cover is Will Clayton. Will Clayton was the major cotton broker at that point in time, and there were 1.5 million people involved in cotton production, so it was very important to the Roosevelt administration and for America. Nobody had assumed that technology was going to solve anything that would create a labor oversupply. And to show you what you have here is that this cosmopolitan cotton world existed on top of an oppressed labor force. This man was Undersecretary of State in the Truman administration. He was the guy who wrote the blueprint for the Marshall Plan. The Marshall Plan was not announced at Harvard at commencement in 1947. It was announced to a group of cotton growers in Cleveland, Mississippi, in the Delta a month before. This man was the man who negotiated the first loan with Great Britain after World War II, and the person he negotiated it with was John Maynard Keynes. So to bring this up to date, during this period in the 1930s, a 10,000-acre cotton farm would require 1,000 people, 1,000 families. That meant 4,000 to 5,000 people. That land today could be farmed with 4 to 5 people. So you had this huge dislocation of people that occurred at the same time as the Civil Rights Movement occurred in the 1960s, compounding the problems. So the cotton world has moved essentially to China. And it's very interesting. There are still 100 million cotton farmers in the world. And China has 25 to 30 million of them. It's a stepping stone to no place. There's no mechanization, because what happens with mechanization? With mechanization, you have people displaced and they move to the cities. China doesn't want that. So that's where we are in terms of cotton. In terms of race, if you draw a timeline again between Plessy Ferguson and Brown versus Topeka, what happened afterwards? And at this point in time, you have the moral clarity of the struggle versus legal segregation moved into the complexity of de facto segregation. And I'll give you a couple examples of that, which we can go into later if you want to. But it becomes very apparent in Connecticut when Abraham Ribicoff, John Kennedy's right hand, favorite governor, joined with Senator John Stennis of Mississippi and said, with an amendment that was said, that you cannot integrate the South unless you integrate the North. And he railed against the hypocrisy of the North. So, you know, the world today is still left with enormous problems. And the question that I'm going to leave you with at this point is, why do those major cities in America with large black populations and no or minimal history of slavery, legal segregation, or sharecropping have the same issues as those cities and regions that did have them? Thank you.
Thank you.